Welcome to the Adult Forum. It is the 12th of January. It's the first Sunday in the new year that we've had classes for everybody. And it's the first of a ongoing series which is going to go until Easter, I think, maybe longer. Which is based on an experience that I had while I was driving to work one day. The experience was as follows. I was driving on the Central Freeway, and I looked up, and I saw the sunrise, and I saw the really super dark clouds. This is a month and a half ago, and I thought, this is a great image, a great metaphor for my experience of life in this San Francisco Bay Area, which is, it is a place of tremendous promise, tremendous beauty, and also tremendous challenge and tremendous ugliness. And it got me thinking about a part of the tradition of, especially the Hebrew scriptures. Well, the Hebrew scriptures, which sort of ultimately culminate in the prophetic ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, which is seeking to tell the truth about the way the world is. And why that is sometimes a challenge. And so, what I find in my experience is that I focus too exclusively on bad stuff and not enough on good stuff. Or I focus only on good stuff without paying attention to bad stuff. And that binary good-bad is kind of a construct to have this conversation. Because I think it's actually much more fluid. But I was thinking about how do we identify both the highs and the lows in our communities? Instead of just, if your experience is like mine, just paying attention to the lows. Because I don't know if you know this or not, but Donald Trump was elected president in 2016. And we have survived well thus far. And what's interesting is in January of 2017, just 3 years ago, I kind of started talking about this spirituality of resistance, or resistance as spiritual practice. And there are a lot of pieces to that kind of resistance. Certainly it is identifying the heavy stuff, but it's also celebrating the light stuff, because you cannot do spiritual practice that is only heavy or only light, and you can't do political resistance that is only heavy or only light. You have to find a balance between those two. And so I got curious about the phenomenon of the prophetic parts of the Hebrew scriptures, which we call it the Old Testament. The Jewish people don't call it the Old Testament, as it turns out. It is the Bible. So I got curious about the idea of prophets as people who look around and identify what's wrong, as well as identify what's right. And I thought, as I was preparing my notes today, I thought, do I need to tell people that prophecy is not fortune-telling? Okay, prophecy is not fortune-telling. Okay? We're not here to learn how to read the future in a magical sense. Nor are we here to learn how to affect the future in a magical sense. Prophecy is not about something that is going to happen at some indeterminate date in the future. Prophecy is about what's happening now. So you could like leave now, and you'd have the punchline of the class today. Prophecy is about what's happening now. Prophecy is like sci-fi. So, anybody ever watch Star Trek? Star Trek is a show about a lot of things, but it's a show about the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It's a show about the Vietnam War in the 1960s. It's a show about the shifting culture, economic culture in the United States in the 1960s. All sci-fi is seeking to say something about the way the world is in a very forthright, deliberate way. I mean, I think all fiction does the same thing, but sci-fi kind of does it in an over-the-top way. Prophecy does the same thing. Prophecy takes a kind of over-the-top look at what the world is like. And prophecy, the prophetic tradition, if you want to call it something, has an idea of what the world as God imagines it is like. Okay, I'll say it again. The prophetic scriptures have an idea of what the world is like from God's perspective. How about that? So then I started thinking about who writes about prophetic literature in the Hebrew Bible, Hebrew scriptures. And I thought about one of my favorite scholars of the Hebrew Bible, Walter Brueggemann, who's been retired since the early 2000s. His last gig was teaching Old Testament at Columbia Theological Seminary in Atlanta. He is a great scholar, and he's a very popular teacher. So reading Brueggemann is not hard once you get into it. And he takes as his perspective on reading Hebrew scriptural prophecy a critique of North American culture. Because he's also kind of a preacher. So it's not like he's just doing dry academic teaching of the Hebrew Bible. For example, he wrote this in a book called Journey to the Common Good. I'm just going to read, it's a quote. He describes how the collective movement from anxiety, fear, and scarcity towards a spirit of neighborhood is the key journey that Jews must make, that Christians must make, that all humans must make in order to be maximally human. It is a journey that requires steadfast love. Hold on to that. And most importantly, it is one that must be taken again and again. So what is the Hebrew word for steadfast love? Somebody knows. You've heard it here many a time. Starts with a ch. Chesed. 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 Huh? Steadfast love. Love.
S-S-E-D?
Yeah. Chesed is the kind of love that stands by you no matter what. And God's love in the Hebrew scriptures is described in many ways, but it's described at least as chesed, steadfast love. So God loves you in a stick-by-your-side way. So let me read the quote again. He describes how the collective movement from anxiety, fear, and scarcity... Anybody familiar with anxiety, fear, and scarcity? Did I mention that Donald Trump was elected president in 2016? Towards a spirit of, and this is in quotes, neighborhood. is the key journey that Jews must make, that Christians must make, that all humans must make in order to be maximally human.
It's neighborhood isn't a place, it's a state.
Right. Neighborhood is not a place. Neighborhood is a relationship.
Okay.
A neighborhood nurtures maximal humanity. And the goal of the prophetic literature is to restore us to our maximal humanity. Okay? Do you know what maximal humanity feels like? Have you ever felt maximally human?
Yes.
Have you ever felt more yourself than you feel right now? Yeah. I mean, it's a gray day in January in San Francisco. The hangover is almost over, and we're left with ourselves. So maximal humanity, the experience of that, is that experience of, as you'll hear in the next sermon, righteousness, the experience of beauty, the experience of connection. That is the state that God, through the prophets, calls us to. And that is the journey that we must take. There's no invitation. My spiritual director gives me invitations. We must take this journey.
So say that again.
My spiritual director.
What must we do?
We must take the journey towards maximal humanity, which Brigham Young describes in terms of neighborhood, which is relationship of connection, which requires steadfast love, and most importantly, my dears, must be taken again and again and again. Mark?
You mentioned sci-fi. So
yeah.
My question is the state that you're describing a utopia?
No, it's exactly the opposite of utopia. It's exactly the opposite of utopia. Because utopia is idolatry. Utopia is idolatry. And it becomes hard to realize that. So I want to talk to you about Walter Brueggemann's teaching. Brueggemann is really interesting in what he does. He begins the book that I'm referencing in these comments, which is called The Prophetic Imagination, which was published. It was a talk that he gave, an academic address he gave it was published in 1978, so it was probably given in 1977. So it's 40-plus years old, and it's in a few new editions. But he begins this book, The Prophetic Imagination, by saying, listen, that was me, actually, these words. The contemporary American church is so largely enculturated to the American ethos of consumerism that it has little power to believe or to act. Okay? Which makes me uncomfortable, especially after, you know, a very successful year of fundraising, so that I can afford my little luxuries in life, like food. But his position is, and this is much more radical in the 70s than it is today. I mean, we've become sort of used in the last 40 years to thinking of enculturation of the church in a dominant culture that dominates our desire. At least I think about it more. Maybe not. You're looking at me like you've never heard that before. Okay, good. He continues to say that the internal cause of such enculturation, he's totally getting up in our business. The internal, that is internal within the church, cause of such enculturation is our loss of identity through the abandonment of the faith tradition. He backs up this claim by saying that our consumer culture is organized against history. What does that sound like? What do you think that means?
Consumer culture is based on the next new thing.
Yes.
Which is always better.
Yes. So history is something that we live with. And as people who identify more or less as Christian, history is vitally important because the story that we tell is based in a history. We may not like it all, but it's a story that we tell that's based in a particular history. So our consumer culture is organized against history. If you amp it up, like if you turn the volume up to 11, there are examples of this which become quite obvious. For example, in the African American community, in the post-Reconstruction Jim Crow era, culture for African American people consumer culture tries to rub it out by making black people into dark-skinned white people. Mm-hmm. What is an example of that?
The advertising campaign for the Marlboro Man.
Okay.
When they first did it, they just took the same old Marlboro Man commercial, put a black actor on the horse.
Right.
And it didn't resonate at all.
Yeah. But sort of the idea of the politics of respectability, the idea of even, you know, cosmetic things like skin lightening creams, hair straightening routines, all of that stuff. That's a really obvious example in our own shared history, for some of us a conscious history, of what it looks like to say that consumer culture is organized against history. Because really, consumer culture wants everyone to only pay attention to what it's selling. Okay, he backs up this claim by saying that there is a depreciation of memory and a ridicule of hope, which means everything must be held in the now, either an urgent now or an eternal now. Now, remember that Walter Brueggemann said something that I will never forget at a lecture I was sitting in when I was in seminary in Austin, when he said, "We must teach our children that when they hear the national anthem, they should laugh at it." Well, it sort of created a response, but he was obviously doing this polemical thing about who owns you? Right? Now hold that in a parenthesis for a second. There is a depreciation of memory and a ridicule of hope, which means everything must be held in the now, either an urgent now or an eternal now. When is the United States of America going to cease to be a nation state? Next year?
Could be.
Possibly.
How does it make you feel?
People will, you know.
How does it make you feel?
How do I feel?
Happy? Anxious?
A little bit of that.
Okay. Here's the deal. We are so enculturated that to even imagine the end of the United States as a nation state seems blasphemous. I'm going to make a claim. I will back up that warrant by saying we still invest in American stuff. I do. I weep a little bit when I hear the national anthem. I know the harmony parts because I learned them in high school.
Yeah.
You know, I have feelings. So that when, you know, the current incumbent in the White House acts like he doesn't, like he shouldn't, whatever that means, I'm offended because we are better than that. And obviously the answer is, no, we're not. We actually elected him to be president, so we're really not better than that. We get the president we deserve. I'm going all prophetic on you. Okay, 3, he backs up this claim. Remember, the claim is the internal cause of such enculturation is our loss of identity through the abandonment of the faith tradition. 3, either way, a community rooted in energizing memories and summoned by radical hopes is a curiosity and a threat in such a culture. There are communities which hold to the hope of the Hebrew scriptural prophets. And sometimes they're very odd. And sometimes they misread prophecy to imagine that it has to do with Well, we obviously have to invade Iran, because if we invade Iran, then that will prompt the second coming, which is, I'm not making that up. That's just a trope in conservative evangelicalism. In millenarian evangelicalism. So, you know, is it a problem that we might go to war with Iran? No, it's great. Because then Jesus will come back and we'll all go to heaven. I would say that is a misreading of the Hebrew prophetic tradition. Yeah, sure. All over. So, but here's the deal. Yeah, I mean, the Secretary of State believes it. So here's the deal. That's interesting, because all of a sudden, and if you read the Hebrew Bible, this will sound familiar to you. Little things will sound familiar to you. All of a sudden, the state and the prophets are working in tandem. The state and the prophets are working in tandem, so that if a prophet speaks against the state, that's a false prophet. So when you say, whoever said it, not God bless America, but God damn America, that was a plain old prophetic utterance from the Hebrew scriptural perspective.
Jeremiah Wright.
Right? And everybody was up in arms about that, because we are so embedded in this culture. Okay? Now, in part I'm saying this because I don't like it. Because I would much prefer things to be, you know, back when the Episcopal Church was sort of the, I don't know, sort of like Rockefeller Republicans. You know, belong to the country club and vote for low taxes. Because that was super easy. It's super easy to be in bed with the culture. And many of the prophets who, you know, pop up, like Amos, who say super critical things about Israel, like, you know, you fat cows of Bashan who lay in your ivory couches and call to your husbands, bring me something to drink, do not end up well. And the official prophets of the court who say to the king whatever the king wants to hear, oh, yes, king, yes, oh, yes, yes, bravo, bravo. And Brueggemann gets into that. Okay, how are we doing so far? Okay. Okay, here's something else. So Brueggemann begins with the sort of archetypal Hebrew prophet, Moses. Moses is the archetypal Hebrew prophet because Moses is called by God to go to God's people, and this is, I can't do universalism just now because we're in a, the didactic state of prophecy at this point hasn't gotten to where it's going to get eventually, which is all nations will stream to Zion and everybody will see God and everything's everybody. Now, God's people are enslaved in Egypt, as you may recall, and God calls Moses as a prophet to go to the people and to remind them of who they are, to remind them of their identity as people of covenant. What does covenant mean? Agreement, contract, agreement. What's special about covenant, though?
It's a relationship or agreement with God.
Yeah, so it's eternal. Can't be broken. Because God sustains the covenant. So, you know, I make a covenant with Libby. I'm going to buy her pony. And then I take her pony to my house and I say, I promise I'll pay you back on Tuesday. And I never pay her. She can come take the pony back from me. Thank you. That's a contract. A covenant is God says, I will be your God and you will be my people. And then the people do things like say, yeah, I don't really like you so much. We're breaking up. And God says, whatever. you're still my people. I will sustain this covenant. You may not like it so much, but it's going to happen. Because God's choice is historical. That is to say, it is based in what is happening really in life. God's choice is to engage people in real stuff. Even though God is like invisible and talks from burning bushes and all this other crazy stuff. So Moses, interestingly enough, has as a job the dismantling of the politics of oppression and exploitation, which is Pharaoh. So you know Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not just a king. Pharaoh is a god. Pharaoh is basically a social idea of a solid nation that's never going to go away. That's why pharaohs get buried in pyramids that never disappear, because they're eternal. That's why they bury them with all their organs preserved, because they're eternal. So Pharaoh represents this culture of oppression and exploitation. So the Hebrew people are in Egypt. Things turn bad. The Pharaoh says, now you're mine. Now you have to do what I say. I will exploit you to death, basically. You will have no freedom. And yes, I will oppress you some more. Moses comes onto the scene and reminds the people of what the covenant that God has made is all about, which is justice and compassion. Because if you look at what later in the story of Moses, where the law is sort of written down and all the customs and practices are sort of codified, what you notice is all this weird stuff like, the alien resident in your midst must be considered as one of you. Not sort of like second class. Is one of you. So the alien in your midst is Libby. There's an equivalence of relationship between God and that person. So Moses comes in preaching this stuff. And then what emerges in this whole process, because as you may remember the story, Moses comes in, there's some plagues. The Pharaoh, the first couple of plagues, Pharaoh's magicians can duplicate. Like the river turning to blood they can do, the frog thing they can do. But the dust rising up and turning into gnats they can't do. And then on and on and on and on and on until the final act of God is to kill the firstborn. Which is not, God's super mean because he kills people. Yeah, sure. But to kill the firstborn means to say, your nation state is finished. There is no there. Because what was there was oppressive and exploitative. Okay, now, you don't have to like that. I don't much like it. I don't like killing people. I think it's a bad choice. And the arc of salvation history goes in a direction which leads us away from the death of others to the choice of receiving God's life. But in terms of the prophetic tradition, God's freedom is the most important thing that there is. So from this emerges not just a new religion or a new religious idea or a vision of freedom, but what emerges is a new social community in history that is gathered around God who is ultimately free. So you may, God is love, God is beauty, God is all of this stuff, but ultimately God is free. Which means God doesn't operate on an agenda that we present to God. Dear God, here's your to-do list. Chop, chop. God operates out of God's freedom. Which is extremely irritating to the Pharaoh. Because the Pharaoh has worked hard to ensure that God is not free, but that God actually operates according to the desire of the Pharaoh. That God sort of fits in the Pharaoh's pocket. Moses shows that God is ultimately free. And of course, in the Mosaic teaching, which will then develop into all the teaching of the Hebrew prophets, the theological insight of that is that human beings are free. That we are not bound by fate, that we are not bound by destiny, that we are not bound by anything but God's freedom. Okay, how are we doing with this? It's a lot of didact. How are we doing? It's a relief. Okay. What is the point of prayer? Okay. You could say that the point of prayer is to change God's mind, to get God to do what I want. And certainly there is tremendous material, both in the Hebrew scriptures and in the classical world, of religious movements that try to accomplish that. So I'll offer, you know, a sacrifice to God, and then God will give something to me. Quid pro quo. Freedom, the freedom of God is that what the prophets say. I hate your sacrifices. They stink. Don't try to manipulate me with your sacrifices. I'm free. I will do what I will do because I'm God. And because I'm God, because I've made you in my image, there is a part of me in you so that you are free. But you've got to keep looking at me, the agent of freedom. Right. Right. I mean, it's like what Viktor Frankl wrote about in the Shadow of the Holocaust, right? The very last choice that human beings have is the choice. Existential psychology. To find meaning. Yeah. Right. To find meaning. That is a freedom that we have.
I'm trying to connect the thing about the covenant.
Yeah.
Steadfastness of it.
Yeah.
With the law.
Yeah.
Supposedly people were following the law when they do their sacrifices and so on.
Ah, interesting you should say that.
So, help me figure that out.
That's going to be next week. Because actually a thing happens where the people of God choose to lose their freedom for the sake of being more like their neighbors.
I think this might be another piece of Mark's question, but not. When we talk about God's complete freedom, I think we also have to talk about God's free choice to be bound by God's covenant.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right.
So it is a by free choice, a constrained freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, God is not bound by anything but God. And sometimes God's choice is what binds God. So that later in the story, you may remember the golden calf. Anybody? Anybody? So the people are led into the wilderness. They're walking around. They're trying to get home. Moses goes up in the mountain to get the law. Things go, you know, take a little bit longer. And you know how people are. Super impatient. So they're like, okay, Moses is gone. So we need a God that we can look at. So throw your jewelry into the fire, and out will pop a golden calf. It's like magic. So they set up the golden calf, and they're worshiping the golden calf. And then Moses comes down the mountain with the tablets of the law, and he's like, holy shit, they're worshiping a golden calf. And he takes the stone tablets, and he throws them down, and he breaks them. So it's like, you don't want the law? Here. Boom. No law. And then Moses goes back up the mountain. And God is like, I am quite miffed at the people. and I will destroy them, and I will make of you, Moses, a great nation. And Moses says, don't be stupid. Remember the covenant. Remember what you said. And he goes on and on and on. And then the text says the most interesting, radical thing. And God changed his mind. Because God's freedom is bound to the covenant. God's freedom is bound to God's identity. Right? So God can say, yeah, I'm God. Hey, I'm God. Boom. But if God stops acting like God, God's not God. And more than anything, God wants to be God. And if you don't believe in God, it's a metaphor.
It's a what?
A metaphor. That's for you.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like the idea of the principles that guide our lives, right? If we don't live by the principles that guide our life, then we don't really believe in those principles. Or we do, but it's super inconvenient, and so sometimes I don't. I mean, I'm like that. We call that sin. It's okay. Don't freak out. And then I return. And if you just put God in for principles, same thing. But God doesn't change in that way. God changes God's mind on the basis of who God is. Does that make sense? I got 5 minutes. I'm going to take it all. Okay, so if you read Exodus, it's a lot of super weird stuff. But it's also a lot of stuff of people sort of wrestling in a relationship with each other. Especially wrestling with God in a relationship. Trying to work it out. As the narrative of the Hebrew prophetic tradition continues, what comes to the fore, which is really quite surprising, is that the people begin to see that a way back into relationship with God, a way into their right minds, is through grief, through grieving what is lost. So grief comes as a response to the visceral announcement that things are not right. I built a golden calf. It's a very nice golden calf. But then things don't work out so well, and Moses grinds it up and throws the gold dust into the water, and the people have to drink it as a sign of, I don't know what. There's grief there. So I'm going to give you one last thing, and this will lead us to next time. Let's go back to the idea of the kingdom, to the Pharaoh. The idea of grieving what is lost is countered by the Pharaoh, by the kingdom, by the empire's insistence that everything is fine. Don't worry about anything. It's countered by the idea that the kingdom, instead of you're feeling bad, it's going to give you a false alternative. Where God is really not such a bad guy. God is really not going to make you change what you're doing. Just pretend that everything's okay. And as long as the empire can keep up the pretense that things are all right, you won't have to grieve. And you won't have to critique anything. Just be happy. So the task of the prophet is to make people sad. The task of the prophet is to break people's hearts. Which sucks. And as my mother said, never ask to be a prophet because prophets are always sawn in half with dull saws. I don't. Yes. Okay. So one last thing, and this is only to sort of close the loop on the current moment. One of the things the prophets don't do, which has become a major part of our current discourse politically, is to say, well, we should look at both sides. You know, white supremacy, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
The prophets are like, no. There is only one side, which is the side of God. Now, that's tricky. Because we've been enculturated to think, yeah, we should look at both sides. You know, I don't want to say anything bad about that person because I don't know, maybe they're right. For the prophets, there is a cold, hard edge that cuts through that argument like a razor. And it's a mess. Because it is not, it's not what we're used to culturally. We're used to compromise. I mean, compromise is the genius of the United States of America, right? We compromise so we can all get along. We don't want to say anything ugly about anybody because maybe they're right and I'm wrong. The prophetic tradition wants to come down solid on there is a way which God has revealed. And it is the way. So, you're getting a sense of how this is a little bit not our cultural norm here at St. Gregory's, right? This is a little bit on the rough side. And I'm not asking you to buy it, I'm just reporting it as a piece of our larger story. Now, next time, I'm going to talk more about the historical event which led to sort of the dilution of prophetic tradition in Israel, which was started by a guy named Solomon. And then in the coming weeks, we'll do some more stuff. Okay?
Are we taking questions?
I will do questions one-on-one, but the choir needs to start practicing. What's your question?